You don't have to look far to find Donald Trump supporters in Johnston. In fact, it's as easy as walking into one of the Brood Awakenings coffee shops on Atwood Avenue, a busy main artery lined with strip plazas, Italian restaurants, and other small businesses. Brood Awakenings is a frequent gathering point for a group of pro-Trump retirees.
I think he will do a good job.
Here's Ralph Petrocchi.
People say to me, well, you left the Democratic Party. No, I didn't. The Democratic Party left me. And I'm sick and tired of them giving away my money to everybody and all of our money to everybody who doesn't deserve it.
Petrocchi says he's a lifelong Democrat, but he got turned off by what he considers excessive American foreign aid to other countries. Like many others in the middle-class town west of Providence, Petrocchi sees Trump as a sharp break from business as usual in Washington.
I think he knows the problem. As a person who's not a politician, he's a businessman. And he's going to run this country like a business. And that's how it should be run.
Democratic Johnston State Representative Stephen Ucci is hanging out with the pro-Trump retirees this morning. Ucci says he voted for Clinton, but he believes dissatisfaction with the status quo explains why Johnston voters saw Trump as a change agent.
I think a lot of people are just frustrated, thinking nothing's coming out of Washington. So it was really kind of a backlash on a national level against kind of some of the Democratic policies. And a lot of the people I've talked to think that the party doesn't reflect them anymore and that it's gone too far to the left.
Too far to the left is a relative term, so it's worth remembering that Johnston Democrats lean to the right, especially on social issues like abortion. That's due in part to the scores of Italian immigrants and their children who moved to the town after first settling in Providence. Johnston is now considered home to the second highest proportion of Italian Americans in the U.S. Democratic Town Chairman Richard Delfino Jr. says many residents in this overwhelmingly white Catholic town get their information from Fox News and take a dim view of issues like undocumented immigration.
They don't want to hear about the racial divide. They don't want to hear about illegal immigration. I mean, you talk about the issue of abortion. Italian families in Johnston go to church on Sunday, and they hear from their parish priest, someone they trust and somebody they rely on.
Delfino says Trump validated the feelings of Johnston voters who think race relations got worse during the Obama years and that undocumented immigrants are cutting the line to enjoy the benefits of being in America.
If you talk to some of the older people in the town, and they say, you know, no one should be entering this country and be illegal. That there is a legal way to do it. And just like our, you know, forefathers did, so should this new wave of immigrants come through a legal process.
I don't know, I just think it's kind of like what's going on and how he's like portraying himself. I don't know, I'm not really getting good vibes from him. So I'm just kind of like letting it go and kind of just doing my own thing and not really paying attention to it. I don't know, I'm gonna see how this goes with him and his first term and we'll see how it goes.
Are you two related? You look like—
We're twins, yeah. Maria Gina.
And Sophia.
Renjigas. We just turned 18 yesterday.
What would you want Trump and, you know, people in his administration to know about your community and what you think the needs are here?
Well, on a personal note, bullying and stuff is like a big issue, and I think if we try to focus more on that and kind of come together and not spread everybody apart, I think that would make this country a lot better, knowing that everyone's safe here.
My name is Ivan Fernandez. I'm a sophomore here at Johnston High School, and I'm 16 years old. I think Donald Trump represents a major change from the Obama administration. A lot of people do not like him. I do not neither like him or hate him. I think with him, we just have to support him and show him as a country, unite, and do whatever we can to help better ourselves, like support him like with all the issues.
Were you surprised that Johnston as a town voted for Trump?
No, I wasn't surprised at all. I kind of saw that coming here. Because at Johnston High School, we had our own actual election, I think. Was it Donald Trump won our own election here? Yes.
My name is Nora Bahra. I am turning 18 in February, and I'm a senior at Johnston High School. I'm Muslim, so I feel like he's scaring people even more. I mean, in the media, Muslims aren't portrayed like how they should be. And that's already like a big thing.
Does it make you feel nervous at all about wearing a head covering or, you know, being open about your religion?
I think it brings more attention when I go out now, but I'm not nervous. I'm proud of it. if anyone does like not understand why I wear it or they're scared or like, I want them to ask. Like, that's wonderful. Like, I would be more than happy to answer any questions that they have.
Hi, I'm Maiku. I'm a sophomore here at Johnson High School, and I'm 15 years old. I feel like it wasn't very surprising for Johnson to have voted for Trump, because I see that a lot of people here share some of the same ideals as him, that those who work hard should be able to have the opportunity to get like more revenue and income into their lives, and that sometimes there are like people who have less honest work who should be removed.
And what about, I mean, we saw lots of protests over the weekend, people who are very upset about things that he says about women, about immigrants. What do you think?
As a young woman and a minority myself, I think that what Donald Trump says about women and minorities is very radical. And as, with him as leader, as like the leader of our country, I think that we can be able to do great things if he were to change his views on women and minorities.
People are not giving Donald Trump a fair chance. And I think if people just think of these negative comments about Donald Trump, and I think they have really the wrong image of what he's trying to do for the country.
My name's Zachary Zambrano. I'm a sophomore here at Johnson High School. I'm 15 years old.
And you have developed an impression of Donald Trump, I understand?
Yes, I do. Here we go. This election was so huge. It was fantastic. Just fantastic. It was huge.
Excellent. So if you could talk to Donald Trump or people in his administration, what would you want them to know about you and about Johnston?
That's a really tough question, because there's so much stuff that you can say. I think he really does have some good ideas on how the country's going to go economically. The way he wants to improve the country and how he wants to keep us growing economically and socially, I think he really has some good points.
Well, I don't know. I just think he's very arrogant. Okay, well, my name is Naomi Aravalo. I'm turning 18, and I'm a senior at Johnson High School. I tend to not comment on it much because it does, like, fire me up, so I just keep my mouth shut and I mind my own business. I just hate when people say, oh, well, you guys should at least give him a chance first. He had his chance to prove himself to a lot of people, and, you know, he didn't do a very good job at it, so that's obviously why people are marching, you know, trying to protest their rights and stuff, but...
And how does it make you feel knowing that, you know, so many people in Johnston voted for him?
It bothers me a lot because we live amongst all these people. And then, you know, when he did win the election, there were so many people that were, you know, gloating about it, not knowing how, like, other people felt about it, not knowing how, like, the minorities felt about it. So it was something that did bother me a lot.
Audrey Giswaldi is 92 years old. She's lived in Johnston most of her life. She's a grandmother of 12 and a maker of meatballs. In fact, her granddaughters have done the math. Giswaldi has made more than 100,000 meatballs in her lifetime.
That's right. They're right.
And that's only if she's been making 50 years, if it's more than that.
Yeah, because you got married at what age, Grammy?
1950.
Yeah, see the new number with that.
That's 700.
Almost closer to 150,000.
So you're really at a solid 100,000, because, you know, a week or two you didn't make them.
On this Sunday, she's already made the requisite 100 or so meatballs for family lunch. I taste one. It's about the size of a golf ball, fresh out of the frying pan, and it's good. You can't make 100,000 meatballs without learning a few tricks. What's the secret to a great meatball?
All the ingredients you put in it, you know.
Okay, that's a little more straightforward than I thought, but Giswaldi is a practical woman. She says she isn't sure how much longer she can keep up the ritual of making meatballs for her giant family, 7 kids, 12 grandkids, every Sunday. So maybe it's time someone made a few meatballs for her. Where better than the kitchen of the Johnston Firehouse on Atwood Avenue? Will the firefighters' meatballs pass muster? Thursday morning, the firefighters have already started the meatball mix.
Are you Richard?
Hi, Kristen. How are you?
Nice to meet you.
It's nice to meet you also. Come on, let's go right back there now because they've already started cooking.
They started cooking.
Yep.
This is Richard Bohm, sous chef and battalion chief. He introduces me to the chefs.
Kristen, this is Battalion Chief Tommy Marcello.
How are you?
Battalion Chief David Anacilli. Formerly owners of restaurants.
On the firefighters' long dining table, Marcello is working a giant bowl of ground meat.
Getting the meatball mix together. So it's a mix of ground chuck, veal, and pork. Just added some soaked Italian bread. And I'll start my seasonings.
What's their secret to a great meatball?
A lot of combination, I think, of the meat, the good meat, and I mean, we use Italian bread as a filler that makes it tender.
And you soak that bread in milk?
We did, yeah.
I thought you were going to say the secret is love.
Nah. I had to tell my wife that if she was here, but with these guys, I don't have to say that.
We already know.
It's understood.
It's understood.
Yeah.
Buonasera, signorina, buonasera. It is time to say goodnight to Napoli.
Every day, Edwin Rivera stands on the tipping floor where garbage trucks from cities and towns across Rhode Island literally tip their recyclables out to be sorted. Some 400 to 500 tons of recycling comes into this facility each day. Rivera watches all that debris for trash that doesn't belong.
I've seen everything over here. I've seen an entire couch. I've seen tires, dirty diapers, all kinds of stuff. Almost everything.
And in case you're wondering, an entire couch is not recyclable. Neither are any of those other items Rivera mentioned. In his 4 years as supervisor here, he's seen non-recyclables ranging from the mundane to the macabre.
The skin of the deer with the head attached was and not just once. The first year that I seen it happen, there was about four of them.
And while Rivera can laugh about the deer carcasses now, non-recyclable items sneaking into this facility are his biggest daily challenge. If he catches them here on the tipping floor, he can point them out and workers and front loaders can scoop them out of the way to be hauled to the landfill. Some loads are so contaminated, as they say, with non-recyclable items that entire trucks bound for recycling go right to the landfill. But many items slip through and end up on the large conveyor belt that carries the detritus along the multi-level maze of belts and sorting equipment in this 75,000 square foot facility. It's one of the largest in New England. In the pre-sort area, four workers stand at the conveyor belt, rapidly grabbing anything that isn't recyclable as it whizzes by, stuffing it down metal chutes. Rivera calls them the first line of defense.
Their number one purpose on that line is to remove anything that could get tangled up or cause damage to the equipment. You'll see them remove large items. I've seen metal doors, engine parts. I've seen an entire concrete barrier.
Items like that make this a dangerous job for these sorters who wear white surgical masks and heavy-duty gloves. Rivera thinks it's likely most people know not to recycle a deer carcass, but people are less sure about kitchen knives, hypodermic needles, and propane tanks. In the last year, Rivera says there have been more than a dozen injuries to workers handling non-recyclable items. Things like wires, hoses, and plastic bags get caught in the system and can temporarily shut down the entire operation.
One of the reasons that we think we get a lot of trash in the recycling is that people are just still confused about what should or should not go in their recycling bin or cart.
Crystal Neuser leads education and outreach for Rhode Island Resource Recovery, the agency that runs the Johnston Landfill and Recycling Facility. She says Rhode Islanders are perhaps a little too enthusiastic when it comes to recycling, accidentally flooding the facility with trash. And she has a deceptively simple solution, changing the signage on your recycling bin.
We joined an initiative, it's a national initiative called Recycle Across America. And the idea behind this initiative is to standardize the labels that are on recycling receptacles across the country.
She holds up a blue and white sticker about the size of half a sheet of paper. In English and Spanish, it reads mixed recycling with images of the four groups of recyclables: paper, metal, glass, and plastic. Each group has some simple rules, Neuser says, which will keep your recycling clean.
When it comes to plastic, the only plastic items you should put in your bin or cart are plastic containers. They have to be a container. So a bottle, a jug, a tub, a cup, those are containers. A plastic clothes hanger? It's plastic. It's not a container.
Most of the town of Johnston looks pretty much just like what it is now, a suburb, a mix of houses, strip malls, big box stores, chain restaurants, and car dealerships. Stick to the main roads and you'll get very little sense of the history of the place. I've driven this particular stretch of George Waterman Road countless times and never noticed the Clements Irons House, a rare surviving example of a Rhode Island stone ender. So now, on this cold January morning, I'm getting a tour from Dan Santos, site manager for the preservation organization Historic New England. Hey, Dan.
How are you?
All right.
Thanks for coming out today.
Picked a nice cold one for it, didn't we?
Wow.
So this is the Clement Irons House that we're visiting today, one of Historic New England's 36 properties. We're on a little under an acre of land right now, but at one point this was a large farm, a center for a large farm. We're in the house of the farmhouse, if you will, right now.
Is this house on the spot that it was when it was built in 1691?
Yes, it is, although the footprint of the house had grown also. So this had grown into a 13-room Victorian cottage over time from the different family members and different families that lived here. But we're in the 5-room original house, if you will, right now.
What happened to the rest of that?
So in 1938, the house was purchased by Henry Sharp and his sisters, and they worked with Norman Isham to bring the house back to its original footprint. We're standing right now in the great room, or the great hall, and this is really a story of immigration, of people coming to a new world and finding the same building materials that they would have found in the western parts of England and Scotland, and then building as they would have known how to construct a house at that point in time. There are just a handful of these stone enders that remain now, and it's very unique to this part of the country and Rhode Island in particular.
I'm Don Buffoni, and we're at Buffoni's Poultry Farm. They're beauties, aren't they?
Here they come.
In the 70s, we were struggling. We were barely profitable. And a lot of it was just the whole change in the farming industry, that they had consolidated a lot of the farms and created these giant corporate farms with millions of birds. And we couldn't compete with the scale, the efficiencies that they could achieve due to the volumes that they were producing. And everybody ran to the big box store to get their chicken, and it was all about price, price point and fancy packaging. And now, after 20 years, they got to see that all those efficiencies came with a cost. Just the humane treatment of the animals and the hands-on approach that you take with a small farm like we have, that you get a better, wholesome product, because we process... What we process today is out the door by the end of the day tomorrow, and we process just what we need for the following day, what orders are on.
8 pounds of 10 split wings.
8 pounds coming up.
8 pounds.
It's Allie Kane. We were looking for sort of fresher, more like farm-based local alternatives to buying something in the market. There's such a difference between a farm fresh egg versus just something kind of just mass market that you're going to go pick up in the in the supermarket. So I think that's probably one of the biggest draws with coming. It's just keeping everything local and very much in-house.
Let's do 4 pounds of breast.
Okay.
And I'm all the way from Cumberland. Like, I drive down here every week from Cumberland. For a Rhode Islander, that's like kind of a drive. So
we have about 20 employees right now.
Mi nombre es Gini Hernandez.
My name is Junior Hernandez. I've been working here at the Buffoni Company for 14 years. They're making progress. What we're seeing is there's more work, killing more chickens. Killing more chickens means business is good for them, so it's good.
It's bueno.
I want to do such a good job for them. I don't want to let them down. I want to show them that, yes, we can outcompete anybody right here. Johnston has the best chicken in the world.
The area where trash is buried at the central landfill spans about 270 acres and will expand to a total of 350 acres by the time the landfill reaches capacity. That sounds like a lot, but it's really only a fraction of the 1,200-acre property. That means the remaining untouched acres hug the landfill, acting as a natural buffer and providing a home for a variety of animals and plants.
There's scrub habitat, early successional habitat, and then mature forests. So it's kind of a intersection of a lot of different habitats.
Samuel Vito is a wildlife technician with the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Wildlife Service Unit, and he's stationed here. His main job is to keep seagulls away from trucks bringing in trash, using sounds to scare them off. But he also keeps track of wildlife species for the landfill agency, the Rhode Island Resource Recovery Corporation.
We're going to one of my favorite spots on the site. There's a pond that beavers have kind of, they dammed it up again. And there's also, I've found river otter latrines over here. Sometimes I've kicked up deer walking back here. And so it's just, when there's not a lot of work going on in the area, you can be back here and you forget you're at a landfill.
Along the path to the pond, we walk next to a forest. A large visible nest stands out. Vito says red-tailed hawks built it. To the far right, there's a capped landfill that looks like a large grassy hill. It's covered in wildflowers and native grasslands, attracting all sorts of songbirds, especially in the springtime, says Vito.
It's actually pretty noisy with the amount of bird activity of tree swallows, barn swallows. You'll have them, hundreds of them just go and they're picking off insects, and you have wild turkey. It's really a pretty remarkable area in the spring when, you know, things are happening. You know, in the middle of winter, it's kind of, you know, like everywhere else, kind of dreary, but.
As we approach the pond, we stop in front of a road that's been flooded by that beaver dam he was talking about.
Well, late fall, early winter, they're going crazy. They're cutting up trees and they want to make a nice stash next to their lodge, which is pretty hard to see. It's kind of tucked away over there. But there's some fresh marking over here, so you know it's active.
My name is Paul Norato. I work here at Town Hall Ains in Johnston, Rhode Island. I've been here for about 17 years. I've been born here since 1984. Believe it or not, some people don't even know we exist here. They come in and say, oh, we didn't even know this was a bowling alley. And when they do come, they're very impressed with the place. We have 32 lanes, a full bar, full lounge, and full menu. Yeah, back in the day before I worked here, I guess they had ice cream stands and everything like that. And then the business grew, they got 8 more lanes in, and we're still trying to build up, thinking about maybe putting a restaurant in someday, and waiting for February vacation, for the school vacation, then we'll really be slamming here. A lot of birthday parties.
Never get sick of this place. I'm here almost every day of the week and I love it. I could be here forever.
Even when we're not working.
Even when we're not here, even when we're not working, we still hang out here. All of our friends are here. It's like family. It's just a really good environment to be in. Kind of like a staple in Johnston.
Yeah, the place you go to stop by and visit a couple times a year. I've made some of my lifelong friends from this building. It's definitely something that, you know, the friendships I cherish 100%.
It doesn't take many people to fill the small, pale blue sanctuary at King's Tabernacle Church. About 3 dozen congregants lift their voices during this Sunday service. There's hardly an open seat. This congregation is only about a decade old. They moved from Providence after buying this New England-style church building in 2015. It's an island of black Pentecostal culture in this predominantly white Catholic town. Johnston resident Olu Olufinlande comes at least once, sometimes twice a week.
It's part of my survival as a person, being able to come to church and fellowship with other church members.
Like most of the congregation here, Olufinlande is an African immigrant. He came to this country from Nigeria in 2002. Modupe Abulime also comes from Nigeria. She's the pastor's wife.
And we come together to fellowship, to worship the Lord, and to create an atmosphere in which everyone will be comfortable, whatever color, tribe, wherever you're from, rich, poor, whatever, any walks of life, because we believe Jesus is the center of it all, and I believe that Jesus is the answer to a lot of the problems that we have in this world.
Abulime works full-time as a nurse. She's completing her master's degree, but she still finds time to attend the church's three Sunday services and Wednesday night Bible study. It's a far cry from just a few years ago when this building was falling into disrepair, says Pastor Chris Abulime.
It was really in a very, very bad shape. I mean, the roof was falling apart. Some part of the walls were compromised. So what we did first was to replace the roof. And from there on, we, we ran into difficulty, and they wouldn't let us continue to fix it.
Abulime says town officials claimed the building wasn't zoned for church gatherings, though the century-old building had been an active church. He believes the real issue was race.
If this was a Caucasian congregation that came in here to purchase this building, I believe that the outcome would have been different. But the fact that we're African-American people and people who are different from you, either people of color, are still seen or treated differently.
His theory was bolstered by an anonymous letter sent to the church filled with racially charged language. Then a building inspector was caught on tape making racially insensitive comments. Eventually, the church hired lawyers and sued the city. They later settled and found an ally in Johnston Mayor Joseph Polisina. Today, Abulime says the congregation has moved past the dispute, but parishioner Dio Inabe says it revealed racial tensions in Johnston she had not expected. She and her husband are raising two young children in the town.
I was disheartened by it. I really was. It made me feel that maybe it does still exist, and maybe we, my family and I, have just been fortunate not to bump up against it.
Most in the congregation say they feel welcome here now. Modupe Abulime says neighbors came around to offer apologies.
People stopped by saying they were so sorry, that it was just a bunch of people, a handful, you know, that did that, that it's not everybody, that Johnston is a peaceful place, we're not bad, you know.
And it turns out the congregation and their neighbors had more in common than some here expected. In the presidential election, Johnston residents, once solidly blue, voted for Donald Trump by a majority. Pastor Chris Abulime says he thinks about half his parish also voted for the Republican candidate, though for some, it was not an easy decision.
He was my last choice, my last pick. I said to myself, I would never vote for this man.
But in the end, Dio Inabe voted for her last pick, propelled by issues like abortion and same-sex marriage, both of which she opposes. She says she liked Trump's choice of Indiana Governor Mike Pence as vice president.
One thing that sold me on the Republican ticket was Pence. He is evangelical. He is a Christian. So that matters to me a lot. The abortion, the gay rights, all that stuff, it speaks to me.
But Sade Olifinlande worries about Trump's language, which seemed to inflame racial tensions during the campaign.
I was concerned about the outcome of all this, you know, what he has said on the TV and how that is going to affect people, especially the minorities.
And that's a concern in this mostly minority congregation of African immigrants. But even during a contentious political season, this community remains united by their faith. And as the congregation raises their hands in Sunday worship, they hope to look for a way forward here in Johnston for many years to come. John Bender, Rhode Island Public Radio. You are